This is the Cybersecurity Amplified and Intensified Podcast. Hey, Vince, how's it going?
Hey, guys, how are you?
Good, thanks.
What's going on, buddy?
Hey, living the dream.
So, do you want to start off by just giving us a little background on yourself and Darkcubed?
Yeah, I'm Vince Kressler. I'm the founder and CEO of a cybersecurity company called Darkcubed. We're taking on this mission and mantle of helping protect small and medium businesses. You know, most of the approaches to cybersecurity tend to be top-down. It's saying, you know, what's working for a JP Morgan or a Bank of America, and how do we dumb that down for everybody else? And that ends up with like Gartner Magic Quadrants and Forrester Research and all these products and services, which never works for small and mid-sized companies. And so our approach is to say, look, why don't we start from the bottom up? And if I had to design a system from scratch that would protect SMB, it would look a little bit like a bunch of other solutions, but not like any of them. My background, you know, I've been in cybersecurity and IT since before I could drive, was an officer, communications officer in the United States Air Force, spent some time in the Pentagon, spent some time at a group called the White House Communications Agency, where I was on the road with President Bush, which was a pretty cool job. While there, I got sent to the White House to be the CISO for the unclassified networks at the White House, which was, it was actually a really cool time back 2007, 2008. And we'll talk about this later in the podcast, I'm sure, but kind of the origin of national efforts around cybersecurity with the Comprehensive National Cybersecurity Initiative. I built the first ever 24/7/365 Security Operations Center there at the White House, and then went on to spend about 5.5 years supporting the Department of Homeland Security in their Einstein program and CPS, which is, you know, a massive cybersecurity protection system. And while there, I got the idea to start Darkcubed and took the leap into entrepreneurship.
I am also IR, cybersecurity firm, you know, down here taking care of a physical pen test that we got to take care of. And
nice.
So we're, you know, we'll talk shop, I'm sure, a lot throughout this thing. But where do you see from your side of the fence in your world, where do you see like where most of the failures are starting to come in from?
I think we're in a massive, heavily funded market with lots of companies, lots of startup, and incredible amounts of money being spent on marketing, an incredible amount of money on the sidelines from investors. And I think most people are missing the point. And the point is most companies don't really have much security at all, right? I mean, you know, from pen testing, like it's not a matter of if you're going to get in, it's just, you know, how quick it's going to take. And it's just, you know, we're at such a bad state. And I think the national dialogue is around frameworks and compliance and all of these technologies when there are some basics that just aren't being handled. So I think that's the biggest challenge for me is like the basics aren't being handled. And it's not because small and mid-sized companies don't want to. It's because they can't. Like they can't afford it. They don't have the people. The technologies don't align to their mission. So, you know, that's the number one thing for me.
So on my side, what you'll probably test this a little bit. I see a lot of times, you know, we'll go through and, you know, we'll break in, whether, you know, virtually or physically or whatever the case is. And then we make, you know, do the time, do the report, we submit it. And they're like, okay, thanks. See you next time. Wait, what? are we going to fix any of these things? I mean, they're like, nah. I'm like, you know, it's like we – you know, me and Shiva joke about this a lot that, you know, a lot of times the pen testing and stuff like that is more of a formality checkbox for them than an actual mission statement to actually fix things, right? So
100%.
You know, and it's really sad because then I'm on the other side of the fence because, you know, truth be told, you know, about 85% of my work right now is IR from ransomware. And then that's when they're like, oh, you know, nobody ever told us this. And I'm like, really? Nobody? Yeah. I mean, come on.
Yeah, 100%. I think, you know, most of the time when you go down market and even up market, but when people are doing pen tests, it's because somebody told them they had to and they just want to check the box, right? And they say, oh, here's the paper. We did it. And that's part of the reason is because it's just, it's so hard to really, you know, if you look at these like, these are the top 10 security controls you should do. And if you're not doing them, you're wrong. Maintain an accurate asset inventory of all your hardware and software. Okay, take a 250-person company and really, how easy is that, right? It sounds easy on the surface, but it's really complicated and hard and overwhelming. Versus, look, make sure you have endpoints managed. Make sure your users aren't admins on their endpoints. And everything else like is great. But if your users are admins on their endpoints, you're done. Mm-hmm. Right? Like that's it.
How do you feel about self-attestation when it comes to compliance and security, as opposed to having a body come in, audit you, look at everything, and then give you the stamp of approval?
Hence the root of the discussion with CMMC and 800-171.
Exactly.
Well, self-attestation does not work. I think we've proven that. It's very easy to say, hey, I think this works. And if somebody comes back and question you, you say, well, this is how I made the decision. So it's really a question of judgment. Versus a compliance body coming in. I like the concept. I'm a supporter of the concept of CMMC. I think how it's getting implemented is really tough. Because what it ends up being, what I'm seeing happening, is the big guys are just pushing requirements down on the small guys, right? What should happen, and this is probably a controversial statement, is the large defense contractors in the DoD that have the resources and have the teams need to take responsibility for the security of their supply chains, not push that responsibility down to the small guys who can't do it.
Exactly, because we're seeing a lot of it where, you know, the small guys, you know, that may only see one or two pieces of document a quarter are required to go through all this stuff. And they're like, oh, well, our vendors, they're all under. So we're okay. We're okay. We don't have to worry about it. All these guys are doing it. And
yep.
No, that's not the way this works, guys.
Yep.
So tell us about Darkcubed. What can it do for us and our clients and just the country and the world, hopefully?
Yeah. As we think about security, you know, we're pretty plain spoken. We don't play a lot of games. We say what we do. One of the key things to help protect an organization, and it's not the only thing you should do by far, is to get visibility into what's coming in and out of your network. And I know, you know, over the next 5 to 10 years, kind of this idea of a network is evolving and changing, but we still have networks. We still have places where our users aggregate. And if you have visibility to what's coming in and out of that network, you can pick up on things like ransomware and Emotet and all these other bad things that are happening a lot sooner. And so, you know, if you look in the market today and you said, what would it take to properly instrument my network to get log data, to get reporting and visibility into it, to integrate threat intelligence, to get some automation and orchestration, that is an overwhelming, expensive, hard thing to do, right? There are a ton of free tools out there. If you have an engineering team, you can potentially figure it out. But it takes a lot of time and energy. And we've taken that entire process and boiled it down into something that can be deployed in less than 5 minutes with no hardware or software. We do that by saying, what's the best way to get visibility into what's coming in and out of your network? Well, you probably already have something that has visibility into that, and that's called your firewall. Now, granted, that firewall is probably not configured correctly, but it's at least seeing it, right? And so we can consume a data feed from your firewall, NetFlow, Syslog, in our SaaS infrastructure. So you just ship that data off to us. And we have the algorithms and processing infrastructure to kind of pull out the metadata from that. So what are your phone records, basically? Where source, destination, port, protocol, data volume. We're then automating a bunch of threat intelligence integration and predictive analytics to say what's good, what's bad, what's unknown, and how confident are we in those assessments? And then allow the customers with a click of a button to say, look, anything that's known to be bad that you're really confident, I want to automatically block. And so the question is, how do you block it? Well, again, you have something in place already today that can block stuff, and that's called your firewall. And most firewalls have the ability to subscribe to a remote block list. That functionality is relatively useless in the general market because, you know, let's take a Palo Alto that can block 20,000 or 50,000 entries. Which 20,000 or 50,000 are you going to block? It's a hard choice. We take that, instead of saying, I'm going to shove a bunch of stuff into the firewall that I don't know if you're going to see, and we turn it into a game of go fish where I say, I've got 300 million things I'm watching. If you see any of them, I'll tell you, you should block it. And then we constantly update and maintain that block list. So you're blocking the threats that are targeting you. That can be up and running in 5 minutes. And, you know, we have a very affordable price point. We sell exclusively through the managed service provider channel. So we partner with managed service providers to help make them better, or managed security service providers to make them better at supporting their customers.
Are there any firewall brands that you guys prefer to work with?
There are some that are trickier than others. You know, Palos are really easy. Sonic Walls are really easy and popular. We have a custom integration we've designed for Meraki's. Meraki's are out there everywhere. They tend to be really underpowered devices. and their cloud, they have their cloud platform. They don't do remote blockless, so we had to write a custom integration to integrate into their API. But that means we can deploy pretty quick. So we have one customer that's pushing out, you know, 150 plus Meraki firewalls through our integration.
What are you guys doing with Fortinet and Sophos?
So we support those as well.
I know Eric's got a question there about zero trust and zero knowledge with your platform.
Yes. I mean, when you're actually going down the whole platform or actually integrating with you and you're actually seeing all of our metadata, where you're essentially seeing in our entire syslog of data that's going over to you, you know, how are we supposed to know who has access to it? What analysts are accessing that particular data? Because a lot of the stuff we keep finding are transmitting passwords in plain text, things of that nature. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of stuff that could be on an improperly configured network or just because poorly coded line of business applications, you're able to see a metric F ton of data.
Yeah, and that's a really nice thing about our approach, rather than taking an approach where you're going to a logging provider. So there are a lot of folks that'll do logging for you, right? And you're sending them everything and they're aggregating all those logs. Our approach is we're taking that stream of data. And the first thing we do with that stream of data is we parse out the metadata and throw everything else away, right? So we're not storing any of the content of those communications. In fact, the firewalls don't send us the content of those communications as, you know, in general. It's more the source destination port protocol, packet vault, you know, packet length, those sorts of things. So we typically don't see the content. And even if somebody were to ship us the content, we'd throw it away before we even process it.
So what verification, just to be, you know, the typical a-hole, I mean, what verification does a company have that you are stripping everything out and you're only looking at metadata? I mean, we've seen time and time again where companies will say, oh, we only have access to this. And 3, 6 months or a year later, they get breached and like, oh, they really kept all of that data.
Right. And that's where, you know, we're happy to kind of open the kimono and show you how our system works, right? Where the data stores, the data tables that are storing, like we just don't have, you don't have slots to store that information. So you can't store it.
You know, one of the biggest shortfalls I've seen in a lot of vendors in your space and adjacent to your space is, as a provider or even as an end customer, we typically do not get any insight into how your systems and people interact with our data. And as I'm sure you know, if you go SOC 2 type 2, you need to provide that audit log
yep.
to us. And I'd be hard pressed to find anyone that does that right now, quite honestly.
Yeah, and it's expensive to go through those sorts of processes, and most customers don't care. So it's a tough business discussion, right? It's like, do we spend a lot of money on this certification process that most people, that the broad market doesn't care about, or do we invest that money into product features?
I'm less interested in the certification and more interested in just having in your portal, in your GUI, being able to click on a tab or a link that shows me an audit log of what you guys are doing with my data and how your company's interfacing with it. Because I have to deal with insider threats at my clients,
right.
My own company, hopefully not, and potentially in your company and the, you know, dozen or so other vendors I may use.
Yeah. And I think, again, that reinforces our approach in the market of, you know, simplicity makes all the difference. There are two pieces to what we're doing. You know, one is when you're just storing the metadata, you know, we can do, we have a patent that was granted in August around anonymization of data. So one of the things we're doing is when you look at a traditional SIEM tool, right, the ability to aggregate data across customers and do cross-customer analytics is a challenge, right? Because people do not want their data commingled. One of the things we're doing that is unique is we're taking everybody's data, we're taking that summary data that I mentioned earlier, we're associating it with an anonymous ID, and then we're putting it into one data set, right? And that data set then lets us look for trends and patterns. And the way we're using that data, you know, a great example is we're tapped into the API for Alien Vault OTX, right? And you have a lot of analysts out there that are publishing threats with IOCs in them that can be very helpful. You know, as soon as any of these major reports get published, those IOCs are in Alien Vault OTX, we're consuming them, we're protecting our customers. The challenge is you can't control the analysts that publish data. So an analyst could say, look, this malware threat is using 8888 as command and control. That's Google's DNS. It would be a false positive. It would screw up everybody if we automated the consumption of that. So how do you consume that in a no human in the loop machine driven way and protect your customer base? And the way we do that is with that aggregated data I mentioned. So we can consume that data, and then we can use our customer data as a noise filter. And we can say, what percentage of our customers have seen this? How many times? What's the standard deviation from the norm? And that can adjust our confidence factor. So we can say, look, 80% of our customers have seen this 33 million times. Either the entire internet's been hacked and everybody's screwed and everything's on fire, or this is way too noisy to consider as valid and we're going to drop it to the floor. And so there are really valuable ways when you think about automation. And you'll notice I'm being very careful about not using machine learning and AI because I hate those freaking terms.
Thank you.
Snake oil.
They're overused in this market. But you know, you can automate when you have the right data, you can automate decision making in really cool ways. And that's what we're focused on, is how do we deliver protection to the masses and how do we use that data to do it? And you know, to anybody that has concerns about how we use the data, you know, we're hoping to having a deep dive with those folks and showing you exactly the data and how we use it and how we consume it. I mean, transparency is the key.
Are you guys doing anything with DNS over HTTPS?
Nope. You know, from a roadmap perspective, what we're likely working on, and we've had discussions with a company that we're going to be partnering with, is taking a partnership approach to DNS, right? Taking a partnership approach to endpoint versus trying to develop it ourselves.
Because I see a lot of, just to push back, I mean, what's the timeline on that? Because, you know, until DarkSide was, I mean, let's not beat around. They weren't taken down by no damn government entity. We've got three cases right now that they are very much in the fucking mix right now. They are just going silent on their name and shame site. They're still collecting money. Yep. You know, so the claim that they've been seized is bullshit. But, you know, NetWalker, before they went down, Maze, when they were still around, Canty does it, DarkSide does it, even though it depends on the operator, because DarkSide is a RAS platform. But, you know, whether it's SFTP or SSL DNS, you know, that's typically their de facto, because most firewalls are not configured to monitor any SSL traffic. And
correct.
If you're not potentially grabbing that metadata or anything like that yourselves, how are you going to be able to potentially alert someone from a cybersecurity threat like that?
Yeah, it's a great, you know, in the cybersecurity world, we end up in this challenge of like, you build a better mouse, I'll build a better mousetrap. And there's still this fundamental thing that has to happen in the internet, which means a packet has to go from one host to another. So whether you have DNS on top of it, there's still IP communications happening on the back end. So if you look at FireEye's report on the Colonial Pipeline hack, let's just say for something out in the news and everybody knows about, you know, their report has a couple of domains listed and a couple of IPs listed, right? So how do you take those IPs and for your average, smaller, mid-sized company say, if that IP shows up on my network, I want to be protected against it, right? It's a simple thing, but it's a hard thing to do. Because of our automation, we're saying, look, I don't care what domain name they use. If that IP is communicated to in the next couple of weeks, it's bad and we're going to block it, right? All stop. So the concept here is not, you know, if you want to be on the cutting edge of detecting new threats, detecting sophisticated threats, break out your pocketbook and be prepared to spend. That's not the problem we're trying to solve. The problem we're trying to solve is most of the reason these ransomware attacks happen is because somebody's left RDP exposed or some credential gets compromised and it's a known host that's communicating in and they're just not stopping it. Right. So you've got somebody brute forcing an RDP host. That brute forcing isn't prevented. It's coming from an IP that's been known to be bad for a year, but they don't have a SIM. They don't have anything else. You know, we can stop that. We're not stopping ransomware, but we're stopping the stupid part.
And that really brings up a great point, because, you know, there's been times and times again where we will, you know, be on a pen test or whatever, and, you know, we'll start hammering stuff, right? You know, doing dictionary attacks, you know, the 1 million passwords, whatever. And it sets off no freaking alerts on the blue team. And I'm like, really? I'm at like 1,000 logins right now and nobody's calling me or shutting down. Nobody's running around with their hair on fire.
Tell them the truth, Eric. You did it on the managed SOC I was using against me and they never picked it up.
Man, yeah. I mean, so like normally when we're on these calls, you know, we're, you know, talking, you know, we're normally in a Zoom room or whatever, and I get bored and, You know, I was actually showing the hotel staff here. One of my greatest tools is, you know, I'm a squirrel. I got ADHD, but one of my favorite tools is this, because most of the time that little half moon plunger is not fully pushed out, and I can break into just about any freaking room that you want.
Yep,
it's just crazy. But anyway, I divert. But yeah, the lack of logging, the lack of notification on some of the simplest damn things is incredible.
Yeah,
I'm like, how did you not notice this?
Like there was,
I mean, it's one thing to run a Mimikatz or not a Mimikatz, but Metasploit to pop an RDP from a 2008 R2 server. That's a pretty quick attack to pop into a server, but dictionary attacks are easily able to be detected. Yep. So, would you say dark side cubed? I keep seeing the three, and I want to say
dark cube, not dark side.
Not dark cube, sorry.
I don't think he wants that association.
I wish I had $4 million of Bitcoin in my account, or $5 million of Bitcoin in my account.
It was 90 million in Bitcoin over the last year. Not year, sorry. This year alone.
That's amazing.
So just a little bit of money.
So dark cubed is more of a, what you say, more of a advanced detection module versus a prevention module?
I'd say it's both. You know, the ability to say, I can take a firewall and not care how well it's configured, get visibility into everything that's happening on the network and block the stuff that's known to be bad or likely to be bad. And the ability to do that in 5 to 10 minutes to get that visibility and information is something that doesn't exist in this forum in the market. You know, we have customers that are using it as a part of their traditional security stack. We have customers that are using it in IR. You know, one of our customers is basically every IR they go to, they deploy dark cubed first, right? And because that at least gets them visibility into what's coming in out of that firewall, what endpoints are communicating, and to get some advanced information. Because, you know, as well as I do, the number of IR events that you go to and you're like, okay, let me see your logs. And they're like, we don't have them.
Logs don't exist. They're a fairy tale.
Yeah.
I'm assuming with everyone going back into the office, you would probably be one of the better options in there with firewalls that probably have not been updated in the last year and tons of endpoints coming back in with.
Yeah, we think so. And we think, you know, look, saying exactly what you do is good and bad, right? Like, we're not saving the world. We're not the silver bullet. But, you know, if there's one thing you're going to do to improve the security of an organization, and we don't talk about our price publicly because of our channel, but it's an incredibly affordable price point. And to be able for a managed service provider, an MSSP, to come in and deliver security at that price point, it's just a really good value. And it lets them then say, you know, is something bad happening on this network? Is it being attacked or not? Is there something going on? So I need to raise visibility and get more spending. It's a lot easier to convince a customer to spend when you can say, look, all of your internal infrastructure is getting brute forced all day, every day, because you have an any rule on your firewall, right? Like, those discussions are a heck of a lot easier when you get data.
One of the things I liked that you mentioned is that you are somewhat anonymizing the data and it's not commingled. Whereas every single managed SOC, SIM, Kool-Aid, whatever, in the channel, all your data is sitting next to everyone else's data, and it's a logical separation with a customer tag, if that. So they get breached, everything.
Yeah,
I mean, that's the real look under the kimono.
I wouldn't say that our data is not commingled, because, you know, I want, again, transparency is key here. But what I'd say, what we're keeping is that summary metadata. So what could an attacker do if they know the IPs you've been communicating with, the number of times and the amount of data that you've been sent to? Like, there's not a lot of value in that data, right? It's like your phone record. There is value there. You can do a lot of really good stuff with it. What we're not doing is we're not storing all the raw logs and all of your sensitive data in a way that if that data were to be accessed, it would cause harm, right? And so I say, like, we lower the risk by, you know, encrypting the data, by reducing the kind of the fidelity of the data, so we're only keeping the metadata we need to process, and then by obfuscating it with some anonymization.
So when you're, to circle back to the IR, where you have a partner or several that are using you for IR, how many times do you find that the firewall has such poor logging history because of improper configuration that you're not really able to help on the IR side?
So we provide value as soon as we're deployed. We don't provide historical value. Gotcha. So we can't come in and say, I can show you what's happened in the last 6 months. But what we can do is you can say, I don't trust anything going on in this environment, so I'm going to get an anchor point of trust with Dark Cube to get some visibility into what's happening, so I can at least start to establish a source of truth. I mean, a lot of the, you know, some of these things are, you know, when It was back when Emotet, I guess Emotet's kind of still around. It got taken down for the most part, right? Back when it was really active, we had a company that was just getting hammered with it. And these hosts were nailing their Active Directory server with false passwords. So all their users were getting locked out. And they had to write scripts to like automatically unlock accounts. And they were fighting this horrible battle. And they didn't know which endpoints were doing what, which endpoints were communicating. We got Dark Cube deployed. And instantly you're able to see, okay, these are the hosts that are causing the big problems. These are the endpoints. We get these blocked and you're able to start remediation. So again, you know, it didn't solve the problem, but it got you the visibility you need to start taking steps towards solving it.
And let's just be honest. I mean, Emotet was more like a daggum troll on a bridge, right?
Yeah.
It dropped its payload and then sold access to any Tom, Dick, and Harry that was the highest bidder.
Exactly.
Right. So, I mean, the threat landscape of Emotet was fucking massive.
Yes. Amen.
Yeah.
How old is Dark Cubed?
We've been around about 7 years. I had started a services company at the same time, and we incubated Dark Cubed out of that services company. I exited that services company about 2.5 years ago.
So would Dark Cube be an MSP built for MSPs?
Labels are hard, but I would say we enable MSPs and MSSPs to deliver better security at a lower cost.
Eric and I just have this running joke that most MSPs come up with an idea, try to sell it to their peers, and security is completely lacking. Functionality may be great, but it just bleeds information like no other.
Yeah, I agree.
So the other thing that kind of segues away, and I mean, Shiva's going to start shutting me up here in a minute, I'm sure, but because like I said, I'll keep going on and on. But I guess what are you able to disclose about funding? Because, you know, when you start looking at companies like Kaseya and Datto and ConnectWise that go around and buy up everybody. I mean, I have a hard on, or I hate Kaseya. I hate everything about
Same here.
Them. Yeah.
You know, in full disclosure, we were using a company called Rocket Cyber for a lot of our collections.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, talk to the owner. Things seemed great, right? I mean, we knew he had growing pains, but I was like, you know what? I mean, he's a cool guy. He gets it. I don't mind supporting him through the hard times while he's trying to grow. He's got growing pains. And then he goes dark on us, and 3 or 4 weeks later, we find out he's been freaking talking about selling to Kaseya for over a damn year.
And sold to Kaseya. And the day they announced it, the day it got leaked, actually, because they didn't announce, Eric and I both canceled our accounts, as did many others.
Yeah.
I guess Eric's question is really, do you plan on selling to Kaseya right now? Because if you do...
No. No, in fact, the hard discussions we've been having lately, I mean, we've been getting a lot of traction. We've been getting a lot of visibility in the market. There are typically like 3 hard questions that people are asking. They're not hard questions, but they're things that people are passionate about. You know, one is, are you going to sell out to one of these like Kaseya or SolarWinds that just rolling stuff up and basically, you know, ruining the product as a part of it, I would say. And, you know, that's not our strategy. Two, the question, there are so many private equity firms right now sniffing around to make this mythical, magical cyber roll-up. And the whole idea behind this mythical, magical cyber roll-up is, you know, buy a platform company, an MSP that has a bunch of customers, and buy a bunch of other products, roll it up and resell it, cut a bunch of costs. Again, that's not good for the market either. And then the final thing is, you know, are you going to outsource the data to an overseas SOC? Are you going to have overseas folks managing? Are you going to lose track of our data? So on the first two, you know, with respect to funding, we've done a couple of rounds to date. They've all been really relatively small rounds. We're gearing up to do another series. We're going to call it like a Series A2 in the third or fourth quarter of this year. We're gearing up to do that right now. And our goal is to raise money to scale ourselves, not to sell out, right? The second piece is a good part of our business that you probably haven't heard about. The DoD is actually working with us. There's a whole group within the Department of Defense called the Defense Industrial Base. These are all the supply chain folks. You know, CMMC applies to these folks. There's a group within the DoD called the Defense Cybercrime Center, DC3. And beneath DC3, there's a group called the DoD DIB Cyber Information Sharing Environment, abbreviated DICE, D-C-I-S-E. And they have the DIB CS program. So many freaking acronyms, right?
Alphabet soup.
Yeah, the DIB cybersecurity program, which is like, if you look at 800-171 and you're required to report a breach, you got to report to these folks. So these are the people, and there were just comments on the Hill about the DIBCS program and the DICE program and information sharing. All that is background. We have a program with them called, they're calling DICE 3, DCISE 3 for Dark Cubed, right? Dark 3. And they're funding the deployment of Dark Cubed on DIB company networks. And this is all happening in a separate GovCloud deployment that's only used for them. We're anonymizing and aggregating that data so the DoD can actually threat hunt and monitor these DIB company networks, but they don't know which networks they're looking at. So now when they get breach information, they can actually look in real time and say, you know, what are we seeing across the DIB with respect to these indicators? And what are new indicators that are popping up? And then we're also automatically sharing the indicators from the DoD back to those companies where, as a part of our threat scoring system. So if the DoD says this is a bad indicator and it's not publicly known, the people in that program get protected from it. So it's a really freaking cool program. But it means because that's a core part of our business, we have to be very careful about, outsourcing data, overseas development, those sorts of things. So that lineage, that heritage for us, I think should give folks confidence.
Now, how much of that information, before you start answering the other questions, how much of that information is being able to be shared with your other partners? And when you're saying, when I say like how much, like you see, you know, something funky going on with a DOD or a DOD contractor or whatever, and they say, okay, now this is really not good. Yeah. And then, everybody kind of looks at it real quick, is that information able to be shared through your other partners to start locking them out from potential threats as well?
Today, we're not doing that. To get access to some of that government information, you have to sign a contract agreement. You have to
Send that over?
Yeah. So folks have to sign and be a part of that program. Part of where we're headed with this next growth round is investing in more analytics capabilities. Right now, 99% of our capabilities machine driven and automated, which lets us keep everything affordable. But there's so much value in our data in terms of trends and patterns that we can do more to help our customers with. So that's a key part of our roadmap is how do we get better lessons learned out of this data and help provide feedback to folks and help continue to carry this flag forward of, really making a difference in security down market.
Would you be interested in the next year or so, unless it's already something in the works, but, for MSPs or whatever that are using a Purge or a Sumo Logic or whatever, a Greylog server, being able to potentially procure some of that data set coming over from you guys coupled with Alien OTX and things of that nature?
Yeah, I think partnerships and information sharing are key. We're seeing, I think a great trend that I've seen over the last couple of years is upmarket. There's a lot of good information sharing happening. There's a lot of people sharing information really fast. And so we've seen when breaches have happened over the last couple of years, people are all over it, sharing data and information. Now, how do you make that usable down market and how do you automate that is still the challenge. So partnerships are key. And I will say we are on a partner with the CompTIA ISAL. So I don't know if you've been tracking that.
Yep, I'm a member of that, yeah.
Perfect. So I'm on the executive council for the CompTIA ISAL. And a core part of, the way Dark Cubed is partnering with the CompTIA ISAL is how do we start to automate the information sharing that we can do into the ISAL? So, and it's going to take us a couple quarters to get there. But to be able to do things like, hey, here's a list of IOCs, which of these are actually being seen actively in the wild and which aren't, which then lets you prioritize response against them.
One of the cool things, Eric and I both use Sumo Logic for log aggregation. And one of the cool things is it pretty much comes with CrowdStrike's threat intel built in. So you can take all of your logs and compare it and flag it against anything coming in from CrowdStrike.
Very cool.
Which would be pretty cool if we could do something like that with Dark Cubed.
I like that.
And it's a secondary business line item for you guys.
Exactly.
I mean, companies like myself, and I'm sure maybe Shiva and some other folks, we would actually buy into some of that threat intel because, like you mentioned before, Alien Vault OTX is a great thing. And I'm a member of that, right? So, I mean, I subscribe to those feeds, but it is a noisy son of a bitch. And you're like, all right, is this real? And it's I understand it's community driven. It's like GitHub, right? So, you got the GitHub of the threat intel, but you got to parse through it. You got to make sure, am I about to drop some code in my development application that may or may not open up a back door? you know, always being able to find a trusted source for threat intel is so freaking hard. And there's a lot of bad threat intel that you'll buy into. I mean, there's so much of it. I'm like, this is just crap garbage, right? So,
yeah.
Have you guys looked into anything from Recorded Future as far as their threat intel goes?
We have not. You know, again, as a small focused team, you focus your energy where you can make the most traction, and that's been on the usability of the platform. We've rolled out new notifications enhancements and new reporting enhancements lately. We do have a partnership with Graynoise. I don't know if you know Andrew over at Graynoise.
Know the company. I don't know the people.
Yeah, it's Andrew Morris, great guy, great team that he's built. You know, they basically have a global grid of sensors that are listening for bulk scanning activity and then classifying as malicious or benign or unknown. And so, you know, as soon as 0 days are released, they're seeing people scan for them. And so we actually have that integrated into our scoring algorithm. So anything that they see as bad, we automatically score as bad and block. And so for us, it's less about how do I enrich threat intelligence in terms of actors and capabilities as it is, you know, our scoring, which I didn't mention earlier, our scoring is 1 through 9. I hate these scoring systems that are 1 through 100 because it's like, what's the difference between 84 and 87? And our scoring is basically a 3x3 grid. It says, is it low threat? Is it medium or neutral? Or is it high threat? And do we have a low level of confidence, a medium level of confidence, or a high level of confidence? So something that's a 9 is high level threat, high level confidence, block and move on, right? Something that's a 7, high level of threat, low level of confidence. It may be a web server that has 150 websites and one's bad, right? And so it lets you decide kind of where your threat posture sits.
I like that mentality. I like that a lot.
What are your thoughts on the recent executive order and how does it affect Darkcube, if at all? Or how is Darkcube poised to leverage it?
I'm not sure it'll affect us. I think, you know, it shows a focus by the administration on doing something in cybersecurity. I mentioned in my intro, you know, I was at the White House back in 07, back when the Comprehensive National Cybersecurity Initiative happened. And if you know Cincy, like there were a bunch of initiatives in there. One was supply chain, you know, one was intrusion prevention, intrusion detection. So on one hand, it doesn't feel like we've made much progress in the last 20 years. I look at the executive order and there's a lot of stuff in there that I'm, you know, I appreciate the administration taking steps to do things. The fact that it takes an executive order to get the federal government to focus on endpoint detection is boggling, right? Like it's just like some of these things are just, they're just non sequiturs for me. Some of the things I like, you know, the federal government's infrastructure needs to be modernized. We need to think about a new approach to cloud. We need to think about a new approach to architecture. We've got a lot of fiefdoms in the federal government and a lot of people trying to protect their infrastructure. It's a controversial topic. It's hard. I've been an advocate for a long time of saying, you know, the federal government needs to have one IT organization that does generic IT, and then individual departments can do their own things for their own unique requirements. But like let's say email, like shouldn't there be one organization running email for the entire federal government and securing it and locking it down?
Isn't that right? Microsoft?
Absolutely.
Well,
here's a question for you based on that.
Yeah.
Do you think FedRAMP works or is effective at what it's supposed to do?
I think all of these compliance regimes, whether it's, you know, FedRAMP or a lot of these NIST things, end up being paperwork drills. It's easy to paper over. It creates a lot of work for folks. I'm not sure it drives security at the end of the day, right? I think the question is, and we've been having, I'm also on the board at the CompTIA Cybersecurity Council, and we've been having a lot of discussions about compliance and security and around kind of compliance should be about proving you have security, not being its own program, right? When you have people that are running compliance programs and creating 60-page documents, but then the underlying infrastructure is completely insecure, that's not helping anybody, mm-hmm. right? And so I think it's a challenge. It's like, where do you draw that line of how do you make sure things are done in a secure manner? How do you prove that they're being done in a secure manner? But how do you not create immense amounts of work around documentation that have no impact?
You know, one of the things I've always discussed with Eric is I think we as a country should drop every single compliancy we have and adopt one. And in this case, maybe it's a CMMC because they have levels 3, 4, and 5. I don't consider 1 and 2 anything because right. there's no logging. So why do it?
Yeah.
But the reason I say this is you have a single language that yeah. everyone is speaking. And if you have tiered levels, whether it's 1 through 5, and then you tack on, you know, top secret clearance and those on top of that, at least you know where you stand and you know what you're dealing with. But having to map a DFARS against NIST, it's misery. And HIPAA and CJIS to me are the poster children of failed compliance.
Yeah, and you have every, you know, state data, state privacy laws. If you're in California or New York, you know, you have different things you have to worry about. It creates a lot of headache. The cynic in me says there's so much money in compliance that it's hard to change that.
Of course.
And a lot of the watered down compliance regimes are driven by the lobbyists in industry that don't want government to do anything. Right. So it's like, take PCI as an example. Right. Like PCI came about because industry did not want government to regulate it. And so they came up with their own scheme. Mm-hmm. And when industry comes up with their own scheme, it has to be good enough to make everybody feel like it's good and secure. Can't restrict business.
Well, that's the same thing with the medical boards, right? Yep. Rheumatology board, radiology board.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the radiologists. They control how many people graduate every year to fix their price that they charge.
Maybe over the course of the next couple of years, we're going to have some natural selection going on with these ransomware attacks and other cyber attacks where it's just going to start taking people down. And we're going to realize like the compliance approach doesn't work. And, you know, as much as people, I'm going to go on a little bit of a rant because like I get into discussions with investors about like their, you know, we talk about what we're doing in our approach to the market and they're like, well, how do you compare to this AI tool or Cylance or, you know, take any other sophisticated tool. And it's like they have so much more capability. And the answer is, well, it's not working. Like we're not protecting the mass market. These people are completely exposed. So put whatever expensive product you want on a pedestal. That's only going to work for 1% of the population out there. And maybe those are enterprises that'll spend big money and make you money as an investor. But there's a massive market here that's underserved that nobody's protecting.
I mean, that's just like the whole conversation going around. What product do I need to buy to secure us? There's not just one.
Yeah, the talking point I use is the punchline at the end of cybersecurity for all the geeks like me is that cybersecurity is about boring old risk management, right? You have to determine what you have, the value of what you have, how much you spend to protect it, and what the best way to spend that money on is on protecting it, right? And unfortunately, and people just don't take the Colonial Pipeline, take anybody else, like, if you have a good kind of AV anti-malware, you have a good, your endpoints are locked down with a relatively decent, say, AD and Intune, where users aren't admins on their machines, and you're doing logging and monitoring. Ransomware, you know, is a lot harder to get through, right? Some very, very basic things. And the discussion that you're seeing at the national stage about, you know, we need to overhaul compliance. We need to do this. We need to do that. No. People just need to simplify this and we need to get some of the marketing speak out of the way and let people get the basics in place to protect themselves. It's so freaking confusing if you're not a technologist and you're trying to figure out how to secure your company. Like go on to any major firewall manufacturer website as somebody that doesn't know technology and try to pick a product. Like good luck.
Most expensive one. That's always the best product.
Exactly.
It must be just as expensive. It's the best of the best.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on going back in time a little bit? SolarWinds. Who do you think failed there, SolarWinds or the government in their procurement and their and how they kept it in play? Because it would seem they vetted them to bring them in, but there was no continuous vetting on the renewals or throughout the product's lifecycle in the government space.
I would say, as a nation, you know, going back to Cincy 11, which was supply chain risk management. We as a nation have not figured out how to think about supply chain risk management as a strategy. I worked very closely with DHS and Sandia Labs on the supply chain risk management stuff. You know, I think it's been proven that if you have access to the supply chain of a product or a service or hardware, that you can embed backdoors that nobody will ever find, right? Mm-hmm. Period. And so if right. you start with that assumption, you know, I don't think the failure is necessarily, you know, There are some stupid things. I don't know how true they are around, like, did they really let an intern set a password? Like some really, really failures like that. But at the end of the day, it's a systemic issue that we do not know how to think about. once somebody gets into the supply chain and is able to compromise hundreds or thousands of organizations because of it, it's hard to say who's at fault, right? Because it's such a systemic issue. And I don't know if you guys saw the report that we wrote on IoT security. We just released it a couple of months ago. But this is one of those issues, like consumer IoT devices. Like you can go to Walmart and you can buy a camera from a company called Mercury for like $34. But what you don't know is behind that company is a Chinese company that just went public called Tuya. They raised like over $950 million in the U.S. stock market. They're a Chinese company. They're basically taking command and control of consumer IoT. And they're doing it, from what I've been told from people in the industry, at below cost. Right. And so
another company I used to own one time was a bicycle distributor for bicycle parts. Okay. And one of my people went over to China. They brought back these really cute toys and they all had to be charged via USB.
Yep.
And when we plugged one in, we started seeing all that flow data going back to China.
Shocking.
It was impressive. And this was 2014, I think, 2013. So this was before China became the big bad wolf, so to speak.
Yep. And so, you know, there are going to be a lot more incidents like that. I mean, we're fighting it at the national security level with Huawei and ZTE. Right? Like amazing gains in Africa and South America on infrastructure, telecommunications infrastructure built by China. We're going to see it in commercial and consumer IoT. These are the big supply chain things we need to get a national security strategy around. And SolarWinds is just a small part of that.
Yeah. I mean, when you start looking at, you know, companies like SimpliSafe or Ring or anything like that, you know, you're adopting these devices to your portal. Who's actually looking into, all right, where the hell is this registration server? You know, I mean, come on, guys. I mean,
a major, I can't divulge too much, but a major like alarm company is adopting some IoT IoT devices that are manufactured by Tuya, right? So again, a Chinese company, and what Tuya is telling all of their all the people that are shopping with them is like, look, we have infrastructure on AWS and it's in the US, so you're fine. Don't worry. but you know, I did a kind of a breakdown of that infrastructure, and it's just copy and paste across the globe in different AWS zones. And the AWS zone they picked in the US happens to be US West 2, which has the lowest latency back to China.
Well, you know, a perfect example of this is Supermicro.
Yep.
Bloomberg has run two articles, one in 16, and they updated it earlier this year. Supposedly MSS put some chips on the motherboards.
Yeah.
But I'd be hard pressed to think that they have not been doing that for the last 20 years. I mean, look what they did to Nortel back in the early 2000s.
And Cisco for years.
Yep. Yeah. That's been a fascinating story to watch, because the first one came out and everybody's like, no, it didn't happen. Right. And then the second one came out and it's like, yes, it's happening. Like it's just amazing.
Supermicro still to this day claims, no, this isn't happening.
Yep.
Well, they can't. I mean, you know, half of the battle, and this is something that I don't think many people understand or see, is it's a mind game as well, right? You need to have these IOCs made public to break our resolve. And then our government has to say, no, it's under control, because if you lose faith in them,
well,
it's tough.
Yeah. And part of the challenge is like, you look at the public discourse around Huawei, you look at people that have been in the intelligence community, intelligence space, and you know, their answer is Huawei is up to no good. And in the public space, like, it's like, well, show me an example, right? And it's really hard to prove it. And the point is, if you can hide back doors in these devices that you can't tell are there, you know, if I were, and China's known to have a very long strategic planning cycle, you know, we're not talking years, we're talking decades. Yeah, let's stockpile this infrastructure, so when I want to use it, I can use it. And we're not going to have evidence until it's too late. And so I think this evidentiary based approach, again, going back to the requirement on this administration and Congress, is to really figure out how to solve this national security issue. The industry can't solve it. It's not going to be solved by the security community. The decisions that are going to be made aren't going to be easy, but you know, something's got to be done.
How do you feel about bringing manufacturing back here, with the caveat that Russia and China still control the raw materials anyway for chip production?
Yeah, I think it's not an all or nothing. I think you can talk about getting hardware manufactured where it makes economic sense to do so, but then thinking about the firmware in those devices. So if I take a device that was manufactured in China, should I reset the firmware with my own firmware, right? So you can still take advantage of some of the cost savings from a hardware manufacturing perspective, but we can do some additional security measures to protect those devices.
But what about the super micro incident where they're putting a separate chip on the motherboard? That would probably bypass any firmware or software updates that we're so good at making.
Yeah, again, it's going back to risk. So how do you manage risk? Like, if I'm putting it into, I volunteer in my part time to run IT and security for my church, right? So I run a data center. It's probably the most blinged out IT infrastructure for a church. I'm running SCCM. I'm doing all sorts of cool stuff. But would I care about buying a server that might have a backdoor to China for my church? Maybe not. Right? Would I care about buying a server that has a backdoor to China for the F-35 program? Yes. Right? And so
they already do.
Well, yeah. So then the question is, if you think about it in terms of level of risk, like, do you have, and there, this was a concept that I'd heard discussed as part of the supply chain risk management stuff is, you know, let's say it's cost prohibitive to do some of this manufacturing in the US. And so out of, and I'll just throw some numbers out there. Out of 100 F-22s, we're going to design 10 of them that are going to cost 10 times more, but they're all going to be done in a separate manufacturing line in a way that they're a high confidence package. So if the bad day comes and we go to war against China, we have 10 of them that we can rely on versus the 90 that we can try to rely on. But if they fly themselves back to China, you know, we at least have something. So I think it's about thinking about the strike package mentality from a military perspective, and how do you make sure that you can survive through a battle? Like,
I think you bring up a good point. I think anything related to the defense of the country should be done here.
Yeah.
Barring the cost. I mean, we just print money, right? We're giving it away 10 ways till Sunday at this point,
yeah.
But it's a whole different podcast. But build it here. You know, you look at China, they're producing their own chips. They're producing their own technology for their armed forces, and so is Russia.
Yep.
We're the only, I mean, not the only ones, but the Western world loves to buy from China to fight China. And I make a joke with Eric, for the trade war that everyone thinks is coming, what are we going to do?
Yeah.
Park the Nimitz off the coast of China and say, don't export to the US?
Yeah.
It's not going to happen anymore.
Yeah, and I mean, the whole, I mean, circle back a little bit, the whole executive order and going around supply chain and everything like that, I mean, you know, when you start taking a look at, okay, Colonial Pipeline got hacked by DarkSide, whether or not they paid the ransomware or not, I guess is a legal discussion that's going to be fought out in the courts. Freaking stupid that we have to have that type of discussion now. But anyway,
they defied Congress and said they're not going to release that information to them.
I guarantee you, they paid the damn ransomware. Whether it was to restore their servers or not, but I guarantee you it was because there was stuff in there they did not want to get public.
Enron Part 2?
Yeah, maybe not. But I mean, when you take a look at, you know, the executive order, right? So if how much would that executive order that you're seeing really have stopped, you know, the whole SolarWinds issue, the whole Colonial Pipeline issue, things like that? I got my answer, but I'd love to see what your answer is.
I mean, there's this concept of like the NTSB review board. Okay, so SolarWinds happens and we pull a bunch of experts in the room to figure out what happened and make recommendations. Again, I think at the end of the day, I don't think this executive order is going to make much of an impact. I think there are other efforts that are strategic. So things like the Cyberspace Solarium Commission, I think they're doing really great work. If you haven't heard of them, they've released a report. And what's good about what they're doing is they're pulling in experts to write policy recommendations that are actually getting put into law, right? Their recommendations are making it into the National Defense Authorization Act to fund the DoD. And like, that's where we have to move, is we have to, like, all of this talk about things we could do or should do, we got to start taking action. Mm-hmm. And even more importantly, going back to kind of the mission of Dark Cubed and what we're focused on, like, none of this is going to help protect that smaller mid-sized company, right? Like, we're forgetting about the small guys in terms of, you know, how do we create a floor of protection and visibility and security for these folks that doesn't require, you know, a computer science degree and a team of 10 and a SOC?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of where I was going to go with, because, I mean, this executive order does dick to have stopped SolarWinds.
Yeah,
it wouldn't have done a damn thing to stop Colonial Pipeline. This is, you know, not to get over political, but it's a dog and pony show, right? So, you know, you can go out there and freaking, oh, I'm doing something. Yeah, great. Shut up. And, you know, it's
listen, it's going to take them 180 days to do MFA. when it should have been done 5 or 10 years ago. So it's okay.
But they have a way to say, oh, well, we need a little bit more time just by submitting a letter too.
So how many years has any expert in the industry been saying MFA is no longer optional? I know I've been saying that for at least 3 years, right?
Yeah, and the fact, I'd say 3 to 5.
And the fact that it takes an executive order for the federal government to figure out that MFA is important.
But Duo was already FedRAMP moderate, so shouldn't it already been in place?
And it's not,
to Duo's credit, to Cisco Duo's credit, they give it to free for the part, the MSP partners.
Yep.
You cannot believe how many times I come across an MSP that got breached. Oh, no, we didn't know. Are you... Cisco. What rock are you under? I'm going to blow that up.
Yep.
Cisco gives, just for your edification, every MSP gets 50 internal use licenses of their premium Duo product. Yeah, so there's awesome. No excuse on our end.
Yeah, that's awesome.
But I know we're coming up on time for you, and I want to be mindful of it. So
Vince, we got to have you back again, man. We really do.
Oh, yeah.
I'm all for it. This has been fun. We should do it a little later in the day when we have some whiskey or something to drink, too. And make the conversation.
Thursdays or Fridays, I'm good. Tell me what you like. We'll have a bottle sent over for you.
There we go.
Anything you'd like to close out with, Vince?
No, I just want to thank you guys for your time and the hard questions. I think in our industry, in the security industry, it's time to start looking beyond the marketing fluff, beyond kind of the fanciful discussions, and let's start getting real about how do we protect companies and how do we do it in a way that makes sense. And, you know, our team here at Dark Cube, we're excited to be supporting that mission and excited to work with folks that are looking for new creative ways to solve these problems. So thanks for including me. This has been a blast.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
For everybody here, Vince, go ahead and how can people reach out to you?
If you want them to.
Google Dark Cubed, darkcube.com. I'm on LinkedIn. I'll connect with me. @ Vince Chrysler on Twitter, although I don't post all that much on Twitter, but I'm there. So connect with me on LinkedIn. Go to our website. We've got a great team. Happy to talk to you.
Thanks again for joining us for the Cybersecurity Amplified and Intensified podcast.